speaker tonight is Lori. Her home group is the White Rose Group in York, Pennsylvania. Please help me welcome Lori.
Hi, I'm Lori, and I'm an alcoholic. Thanks, Dave, for having me out here. A bunch of you welcomed me. I really appreciate that. I just want to let you know, on my way here, I'm used to driving like on long trips with women, and tonight was not the case. I was with my friend Ben and John, and it was exactly the way it was supposed to be because I'm not in charge. But you know, on my way here, I'm used to being with women, and like we've got some newcomers in the car. We usually have a speaker tape going, and on my way here, I ended up jamming to Rush with lighters in the car, and yeah, it was pretty awesome. Anyway, so I was just listening to Dave read the steps. Well, let me start off with that. I'm Lori, and I'm an alcoholic, and my home group is the White Rose. It's a speaker meeting. It meets Friday nights at 8:30 on Haynes Road in York, and if you're ever there, come out. It is, to me, the best home group in the world, and like I hope everybody else feels that way about their home group. I was listening to Dave read the steps, and like my favorite step is the seventh, you know, when I absolutely saw that I ended up to be the person I never thought I would be. You know, that step was really easy for me. So when I heard him reading it, I immediately just looked up at him. I don't know why. It struck me tonight, you know. Anyway, I have a sponsor who has a sponsor, and I have the privilege and honor of sponsoring women in this program. As a matter of fact, I have two wayward children at my house now that couldn't come tonight. Anyway, once in a while, I have to take them in, you know what I mean? I don't have to. It's just something I just feel if it's right, I do it, you know, and there's times I don't feel it's right, and I can't do it, but sometimes, you know, God just opens my eyes, and I see that, like, somebody's a little willing, you know, and that's all it takes for us, just to show a little bit of willingness, you know, when we get here. I'm supposed to tell you what it was like, what happened, what it's like today. What happened was, I am one of eight kids. My mother had eight kids in 6 years. Don't try that at home. Well, none of us are a year apart. She had a set of twins, but that still doesn't add up if you figure it out. But it happens, you know. And so anyway, I'm one of eight kids. I had a father and mother who absolutely loved me and showed up in my life as often as possible. My father worked at a bank for most of his life, and he had like two other jobs too. My mother was an accountant. My father worked like three jobs to feed and clothe all eight of us. By no means were we rich or even middle income, you know what I mean? It was eight kids running around trying to feed us. It was pretty, you know what I mean? It was like, it was a four-bedroom home, and it was pretty tight in there, you know? But like I said, there was eight of us growing up, and like at the dinner table, you know, like, my father, we all sat down with the family, and he, you know, one of his questions was, you know, what's the best thing? He would go to each one of us, you know, from youngest to oldest, and what was the best thing that happened today, and what was the worst thing? And he would say, oh, it's a good day at the Houlihan residence, you know, regardless of whatever it was that came out of our mouths. And, you know, I was the fifth one in line, you know, and I was like trying to shovel, at a certain age, I was like shoveling in my food because I knew what my day was like, and it was not like the rest of my brothers and sisters. It did not include helping old ladies across the street. You know, it did not include getting, you know, showing up to class early so I can get, like, an extra hour of study time in. You know what I mean? Like, that was not who I was. You know, I know this is Alcoholics Anonymous, but at the age of 12, I was doing things that, like, 12-year-olds just don't do. So I was, like, shoveling in my dinner. So they did not know, you know what I mean? I just couldn't get myself to tell them what I was doing that day, but I didn't want to lie. I knew it was wrong to lie, you know, so I would just eat real fast and excuse myself, you know, a lot. And so anyway, growing up, you know, I have a family. They played together, not me. You know, they would be like ripping dresser drawers out playing school, like flipping them up after my mother cleaned all day. Like, I don't know where they got those ideas, but they would, like, play school. And, like, I was never part of that, you know what I mean? That's a big waste of time. I didn't even like school when I was there. Why would I want to play school? You know what I mean? And I was smart, you know what I mean? I was absolutely like, you know, God definitely blessed me with intelligence. That was my biggest problem when I got here. You know, I knew everything on the way here. Ben said something. I'm like, you know what that really means? I still got that, you know what I mean? I'm like, oh, where did that come from? You know? But it is, you know, there's a lot of useless information up here, you know, and at some point I thought it was going to be, you know, my vision of happiness. I needed to be really smart and really rich to get ahead in life, and I started that at a really young age. And I know, like, at some point in my life I cared about people. And another part of my life, you were in my way, you know, and everything that got in my way had to go. But I saw that, like, when I was really, really young, the man who I loved and admired, and he was my hero, was my father. And he worked, like I said, 3 jobs to feed and clothe all 8 of us. And I remember one Christmas, about 5 years old, sneaking down the steps, seeing that man putting gifts under the tree. And I realized at that point there was no sin. And the man that I loved, that I knew worked really, really hard every day to take care of us, probably put in a few hours of overtime just to get me that gift or whoever's gift that was. And I meant, at that moment, I had this thought that I would never, ever show up and be a taker, you know, and that was young. And I thought, you know, I'm going to do whatever I can to add to this man's life and help him out. And I meant that with all my heart, you know. And then later on in life, years later, I meet this man that I love and I marry him, you know. And I wanted to be the best wife. I really did. I wanted to be a great mother to his children and show up and make the perfect dinners, you know, and keep the house beautiful. And we were on a vacation out in Santa Cruz, and, like, both of us were drinking pretty heavy, you know. And on the way back to the hotel, he passed out some shrubs, and I left them there, you know what I mean, because he was slowing me down, you know. I mean, I know that I did not want to be that person at some point in my life. But like I said, that 7th step, when I got to that 7th step, it was really, really easy for me to ask God to please remove those things from me, you know. It's not who I wanted to be, but it's who I became. So anyway, graduate high school. Okay, graduate high school, 36 in my class, very smart, arrogant as well. Okay, growing up, I loved my father, I adored him, my mother. Slept till noon, I did not believe that's what a mother should do. My perception of what a mother was is not what she was, and I treated her accordingly. I was disrespectful, I was ignorant, I was arrogant. We would line up at night to kiss both parents goodnight, and I would never get in her line. I would just walk right by her, and I know it hurt her, but at that time I didn't care. You know, I believed what I was doing was fine, it was justified, and she didn't deserve that from me, you know. I don't know where that came from, but I just know that that's who I was. I started drinking at a really young age, guys. I can't sit here and tell you I remember my first drink, because I don't. But I can tell you I remember the first time I had the DPs. I was 12 years old. My father drank. He drank a lot. But I don't believe he was one of us. I'm not really sure. I know that when my father died, he died 11 years sober. And at his funeral, I was drunk. So never came to AA. You know what I mean? So anyway, my father drank Seagram 7 whiskey. There was a bottle every day on top of our refrigerator that wasn't locked up. and I proceeded to drink from this bottle often, pretty much every single day. And I came home one day and the bottle was gone. And the next day the bottle was gone. And I was really, really sick. And I was shaking. And I know now that that was definitely alcohol, like withdrawal from alcohol. But I didn't know that then. I just, you know, I had no idea what that was. You know, I didn't even know what an alcoholic was. But I continued on that path. I was really great in sports. My father, actually, before he married my mother, he was drafted for the Mets. He was a great ball player. He could bat righty, bat lefty, catch righty, catch lefty. And a week before he went away to camp, he put a jackhammer through his foot. So you know, there was 8 of us, and out of all 8 kids, I was the only athlete, you know, and I love sports. And everything that I did, 6 years of basketball, however many years of baseball, softball, he showed up every practice, every game. He practiced with me. He was right by my side, you know. And so this one day, I always thought that I played better drunk or with some drinks in me or something in me. So I finally make All-Stars this one year, and I'm like walking back because I have to get something in me, and I have to walk to the next town at this point to get what I needed. And on my way back, I was totally trashed, and I was walking through behind a used car lot. I was just going home to get my glove to show up at practice because I'm like the star player and I've got to be there, you know. And what happened was this dog just came out from God knows where. He was on a chain from here to where that exit sign is, and he proceeded to eat my arm. I was lunch. You know, he looked like he hadn't eaten in like months. And anyway, needless to say, finally the owner came down and got the dog off me. And my arm was like, at that time, I didn't know because I had a sweatshirt on, which was holding my arm together, but I didn't realize, and I had, like, the guy just let me go. He just, like, nobody stopped me. I walked from there to through town. I lost like a third of my blood. I don't even know how I survived. But I walked into my door, and my mother, who still sleeps till noon, is in bed because it's not noon yet. She's still in bed. So my sister's on the couch, and she just takes one look at me, and she starts screaming and freaking out. She's like, she's hysterical, and I can't even stand her, so I have to slap her with my good hand to shut her up, you know. And then my mother hears her, and the cover's still flying, the ambulance is there, and I'm in surgery for 11 hours, and they tell me I'm probably never going to use my arm again because the dog severed every nerve in my arm, and I was like, oh, man, that really sucks, you know. And, of course, that's not true because I worked really hard to make sure that wasn't true, you know. So anyway, I continue like that, you know what I mean? I didn't see that back then as like a consequence of me doing what I do, you know what I mean? I really just thought like, you know, that owner should be locked up because that dog was starved, you know what I mean? It was absolutely somebody else's fault that happened to me. The fact of the matter is I was so trashed. I didn't see the beware of dog signs, no trespassing signs. None of that was like, you know, apparent to me. It was all somebody else's fault. And so anyway, I go through life pretty much like that. I graduated high school, 36 in my class. I had a boyfriend when it was convenient. You know, if you're doing what I'm doing, you know, we can absolutely go out. If you're not doing what I'm doing, there's no shot. You know what I mean? I'm so arrogant. I'm so self-centered. I'm selfish. And I drink a lot. And I'm out a lot. And I'm never home. And I can't show up for things, you know, so it's easier for me to just not date than it is to, like, date and be expected to show up at parents' houses for dinner, and I'm not capable of those things, you know. So anyway, I sort of dated this guy on and off for 5 years because, you know, every once in a while I got lonely, you know, and we'd get back together, and I graduated, and I was given a 4-year scholarship to pre-law school. And what I did was, my father started to get ill at this time. He was diabetic, and he had to leave his job, and there were still 4 kids at home. And what I decided was that I don't need to go to that school. I'm going to go to a local community college and, you know, get a bachelor's and whatever, and then I'll go back. I'll go to law school, you know. And so I proceeded to go to college. I was there for about a year and a half, and my dad got really ill. He lost his leg. And I decided at that point I'm going to take a year off of college and I'm just going to move back in my house, my parents' house, and take care of the other 4 kids, you know, because it's really hard for my mom to do it. And at this point, my mom and I can't stand each other. There is no love lost between us. I don't ever say goodnight. I don't ever give her a kiss. You know, I just walk by her like she's not there. And that was really, you know, I was really just a nasty, horrible child as far as, you know, my mom's concerned. But if you ask me anything about my father, like, I would do anything for that man. I would show up, and I wanted to be the perfect daughter, you know. When I said those things as a small child, like, I did not want to be a taker. I meant that, you know. So what I went to my father, and I said, I'm going to take a year off from college, and I want to just move back home and help you and mom out. And he's like, no, don't do it. You know, please don't do it. We've got an opportunity here. Do this. And I'm like, you know, I'm just going to do it. I had a good job at a law firm as legal secretary anyway. It was only part-time, but I went to work full-time. So I moved back home. And it was my 19th birthday, and I decided that after work, I deserve to go to a George Thorogood concert. Okay, I don't have to go home for dinner because I'm 19, I'm working full-time, and I'm helping out at home. So I did. I went to a George Thorogood concert, and this is the 1 year my family decided to have a birthday party for me, you know? Yeah, and where am I? I'm at a George Thorogood concert. So I come home, trashed, of course. I'm never in any other state usually when I walk back into my house, and that's if I'm capable of walking. So I walk in and I look, and there's like this empty cake box on the kitchen table, and like this plates and stuff hanging around. And I turn around, my mother comes in with her arms folded, you know, with that look, just with that look, you know. And I'm like, and I'm sarcastic, and I'm drunk, and what comes out of my mouth is, you know, I guess that saying's true: you can't have your cake and eat it too. And she proceeds to punch me in the face, and she broke my nose, and both blood, like all the blood vessels. I had 2 shiners, and of course I move out the next day. You know, she didn't have to ask me to leave. You know what I mean? It was definitely something I wanted to do. It was a big mistake moving back in. Anyway, for the next what was it? Maybe another 2 years. I just drink all the time. I work. I drink. I work. I drink. Play softball. I'm playing softball 7 days a week. And now I'm only playing for tavern leagues because it's real convenient, you know. If you win or lose, you go to a tavern either way. you know, and that's what I'm about, you know what I mean? So I'm showing up at work, leaving work, going right to the bar, and then going to a game, and then going back to a bar. And that's what I do 7 days a week. Until one day, I meet this man, and I go to play a baseball game. And again, I actually met this gentleman when I was 19. I was 19, I'm showing up at a baseball game, and I'm waiting, this team is finishing up, and I'm sitting on the bench with my friend, and this guy walks over, he takes this big wad of chew out of his mouth, and he sticks it on the bench, and then he goes up, and he hits the ball, and he hits the home run, and he comes back, and he takes the wad of chew back off, and he sticks it back in his mouth, and I looked at my friend, and I said, "Who's that?" And she said, "That's Lucy Walsh," and I'm like, "Really?" I'm like, "I'm going to marry him." She's like, "You're going to marry him?" She's like, "He's the biggest pig in Pinebrook." I go, "I'm going to marry him." Well, for the next almost 3 years, this man asked me out, like, weekly. And I every time he asked me out, I said, "No, you're the biggest pig in Pinebrook. And when you want to date a nice girl, you come see me." And on my 21st birthday, I'm at a bar that I play softball for, and I drink constantly there all the time. And I'm at, now listen, I've been drinking at this bar for almost 4 years, and I'm having my 21st birthday party there. You know, the owner's like, "Oh my God, I'm going to kill this girl." And I have all these people there, and I'm trashed. And my friends at this point think they know what's wrong with me, and they're trying to set me up on blind dates. So I've got this guy named George to my right, the ex-boyfriend I've been dating for 5 years that we break up on and off. He decides to surprise me. He comes in from art school in Philly, and he's sitting across from me. And I'm looking at those two, and in walks the guy that I really want to marry for 3 years. But I don't, you know what I mean? He's definitely going to, he's going to chase me until I catch him, you know? I'm looking at these two, and then he comes over and he says, "Can I buy you a drink, Luke?" And I'm like, "Absolutely." And I just leave those two sitting there staring at each other, and I go up to the bar, and with like a drink later, we're gone. We're out of the bar. We go to another bar because a friend of mine is DJing, and I'm sitting on this radiator, and I feel this wind in my ear, you know, and I'm like, I look up and it's Luke, and I'm like, "What are you doing?" He's like, "I'm blowing in your ear. Doesn't it turn you on?" And I'm like, "Yeah, it does." And like a year later, we're married. I have two kids immediately. No, I have two kids 8.5 months apart. You see the path I'm on? Okay. So I find a doctor at the age of like 22 to tie my tubes. That's impossible to find. But I am willing to go to any length to stop anything I think that is going to stop my vision of happiness. And that includes having 8 kids. There's no way I'm having 8 children, okay? I am going to go back to college, you know what I mean? And I'm going to be the lawyer, and I'm going to be the best wife, and these 2 kids, that's all I need. I don't need any more, you know? And I found a doctor, and he did, you know? He tied my tubes at the age of 22. My kids are actually the same age for almost 4 months, you know? And I tell people that, I'm like, I think that's like a world record thing, you know? Except for over in Africa, you know what I mean? I'm not really sure, but I think it's like a world record thing, you know? And so anyway, I have these 2 little babies, and I never go back to college. But what I do is I proceed to, I have some really good jobs, you know, and I'm making a really good income, and my ex-husband has a really good job, you know, we both have political jobs, and we're doing the deal, you know, we're trying to be husband and wife, and parents, and what happens is I'm married to that man for 13 years, and within that marriage, I end up in treatment at least 3 times, because I like some other things that he doesn't like. You know, and I need those other things to keep me being the mother and the wife and PTA president and farm league coach and employee of the month. And, you know, I'm running around like a lunatic trying to do all these things that I think I'm supposed to be doing. I have no clue what I'm doing. I absolutely have no clue. Because I'm basing my life on this vision that I have as a young child, and I've never stopped to consider any other life, you know. I never was looking around to see what was being offered me, because I was always thinking about myself, you know, what I could take and not what I can give. And I am getting it in daily, guys. And, you know, the only time I usually end up in a treatment facility during that marriage is when he comes home earlier than I do that day, and he gets the bank statement. And he notices there's a little money missing from the savings, you know. And, of course, he asks me what's going on here, and I go and pack a bag and say, "I'll be back in 28 days. You know, and then I show back up, you know. I show back up in their world, and I'm like, "No, mom's back, and your wife's back, and I'm cooking the dinners again, and I'm going to work." And I've done that on a few occasions. I've stayed without a drink in my system because I believed at that time that was my problem, you know. And I've been told, "Go to AA, you know, go to AA, get a home group, get a sponsor." And I'm like, "Oh, all right," you know. And I would get out, and I'd go to AA, and I'd go to one meeting, and I'd be like, I look around and I'm like, that's not me. You know, I'm not them. I still have the husband, the car, the job, you know, the kids. I've got a lot of things waiting for me in my world, you know what I mean? I just need help stop drinking because I absolutely believe that's my problem, and I didn't stick around long enough to listen to any other solution being shared. I wasn't open-minded. I'm sure it was being shared. I just wasn't listening. The husband drinks a lot like I do, actually. He's absolutely one of us. He'll admit that today. But what I refuse to do is let go of that, you know what I mean? Because I absolutely believe he's my problem, but every time he puts his hands on me, it allows me to drink the way I want to drink. I heard my sponsor say it once before, you know, he feels a little guilty and he leaves me alone for a while, and that's been my case, you know. 13 years in that marriage, I have ended up with 3 broken arms, I've been strangled, I've been stabbed, and I am absolutely not a victim, guys. I have showed up for all that. It allowed me to drink the way I wanted to drink every single time. You know, I could have left that man long ago. I could have went to AA a long time ago. I could have heard a solution being shared, but I had what I believed was going to make me happy, and that was the house, the husband, the kids, the job. You know, all those things that I thought I had to have to be successful in life. And it did not include 8 kids. It did not include me working 3 jobs. You know, I admired and loved that man, but I didn't want to be either one of those. I wanted to be my father in the aspect that every time he went somewhere and I was with him, he would put his hand out and everybody was champ. You know, what's up, champ? And he meant it. You could see it when he was shaking their hand. And I'd be like, oh my God, here they come again. I got to say hello. You know, like we weren't the same in that aspect. I was filled with fear and I didn't know it, you know. I've had periods of, like I said, dryness 3 years at a time. But this is me as a mother just without a drink. I'm running up the first baseline of my son's team. I'm coaching his farm league, and I'm yelling at my 6-year-old son to catch the effing ball. I'm in a bank parking lot with my son in the car, and there's a guy beeping the horn behind me, and, like, there's 3 cars ahead of me and 6 behind me. This guy's laying on the horn, and I'm, like, getting annoyed because I think he's laying on the horn at me, you know? And I get out of my car, and I go up, and I'm, like, you know, on his window until he rolls down the window. And I'm like, do I look like Jesus Christ? And I'm screaming in this bank parking lot, like drive-through. And that's not bad enough. I yell at my son, who's 6, who's already traumatized at what his mother just did, to get out of the car and come take a look at what a real asshole looks like, you know? And that's me just without a drink. Just without a drink, you know what I mean? Because drinking's my problem. And everybody else is the problem, you know? My last time that I was in treatment and I was in my marriage, I had 4 years and 2 months without a drink. That's it. Now, I did go to AA for a while. As a matter of fact, I was secretary of my home group. Never did a step. Don't even know how I lasted that long, guys. Don't suggest this to anybody. The only thing I could tell you is I had those other outside things I was trying to control and manage. You know, I'm not sure why, and it's really not important. I can tell you that it wasn't long before I found that solution again. But what happened was, again, he's the problem. And I am just not drinking. And I decide, here's another one of my solutions. Of course, he's the problem, and I want him dead. So I joined the police academy. Okay, now I can kill him legally, all right? So I'm in the police academy. I'm going part-time a night. I have 6 months in. And he comes this Sunday, and he's playing softball because it's his day to play softball. And I make dinner that day just like any other Sunday dinner. You know, we go to church, Sunday school, dinner with his parents, and then I go home and cook a dinner for later on in the day. And he comes home like 8 hours late. He's trash, and he's not happy because his dinner's cold and there's spaghetti everywhere. And the next thing I know, I have a fork sticking out of my side. I'm thrown through a dining room door, and I get up because we've just had the hardwood floors refinished, and I got up, I had shoes on, but he went around as if he normally would to get me, and he had socks on. He had kicked his shoes off at the door, and he went sliding down like a drunk on a hardwood floor wood, you know? So I got up, and it was just enough time for me to get up. I ran through the kitchen, and I was running through the sunroom, and what I normally do is I run in the bathroom, and I lock the door, and he breaks the door down, and, you know, that's that. And so this time, when I was running through the sunroom, I saw my son's Little League aluminum bat, and I've been playing softball for 30 years, and I could swing a bat. And I stood there, and I said, this man is never going to touch me again. And I held that bat up, and I waited for him to come around the corner, and I nailed him right in the back of the head. And, you know, it's not funny. But But I did. I nailed him, and he went down, and I knocked him out cold, and I thought I killed him. And by this time, both my children are on the steps with 911 because this is the normal thing for our family. You know what I mean? And like, that's really sick, but that seems so normal to me. You know, so I hear my kids on the phone, and I go and I take the phone, and I told the 911 dispatcher she needs to send an ambulance or a cop or whatever because I think I killed him. And they do, and they show up. And they pretty much had it with us by now. You know what I mean? He has a political job. I have a political job. And they're really done with us, you know. And here's another thing. I'm in the police academy, so I know half of these guys that are showing up here. And we play softball with these guys all the time. So when they showed up, they said, look, you know, the only thing we can do here is press charges against either you both press charges against each other or, you know, we don't know what else to do with you, you know. So I said, okay, look, let me just pack a bag and get my kids and just get out of here for a little bit, and then I'll go and I'll follow PFA. And he said, okay. So that's what they did. They allowed me. And I went and I followed the PFA. And at this time, I went back to AA. For some reason, I just went back to AA at this point. And I still have these ideas, okay, because I still believe that he was a problem. You know, he was drinking, and if he would just stop drinking, our marriage would be perfect. You know, he would just do what I want him to do. And I have no idea that he's alcoholic, you know what I mean? I just think he's a jerk, you know? Like, he would just be my husband, you know? But, so anyway, I show up in an AA meeting, and I think that I need a divorce. And what I do when I come to AA is I get exactly what I'm looking for every single time. So what I'm looking for is a divorce. I wasn't looking to get sober, I was looking for a divorce. Because I'm already sober in my eyes, I'm just not drinking. And I hear this woman share in a meeting with 13 years sober that she just went through a divorce, and I went up and asked her to be my sponsor. And what I got was a divorce. I didn't get sober, you know. I didn't ask her to take me through the 12 steps, you know. So anyway, 4 months, it was like 4 months later after all that occurred, I had the PFA against him. I filed for divorce. He broke in the door at like 3 in the morning. It was his night with the kids. He was allowed visitation because he really was a good father. He never laid a hand on those kids. You know, thank God for that. But anyway, he was allowed visitation. He broke in the door. And he grabbed me by the throat, and he put me up against the wall, and he said, look, you have an hour to decide. Either you're taking me back, or I'm going to kill you. And I knew he meant it, you know. So I'm like, look, just go pack a bag. Come right back, you know. I'm like, just go get your clothes. Go get the kids. Come on up, you know. So what I do is, as soon as he darts out the door, I grab a bag. I get my stuff together in a bag, and I do exactly what somebody who lives in fear does. I have no solution, no sponsor, because I'm not calling anybody. I go to the bank, and I withdraw some money, and I move to Pittsburgh overnight. I just moved to Pittsburgh. I don't know anybody in Pittsburgh. I don't have any family in Pittsburgh. I don't know why I chose Pittsburgh. I just thought it was on the other side of the state, and I might be safe for a while. And so I get off a bus. I didn't even drive. I took a bus. I figured he'd find the car. And I get off the bus, and I stay at a hotel for a couple nights there, and I'm still not drinking. And what happens is 3 weeks there with no solution, no sponsor, nothing. What do? I do exactly what I know how to do. I pick up and I start to get it in me because, you know, my life is a mess and he's to blame and I can't see my kids. And, you know, in the meantime, I have a friend back here who's in the DA's office and I call him and I'm like, well, can you do me a favor? This is what happened and I'm here. And he's like, well, look, he goes, you know, he's not. You need to stay where you're at until we get enough evidence against him. I'm like, okay, I can do that, you know. So I did, and like I said, 3 weeks later, I'm drinking. I'm absolutely drinking, and other things, of course. And I'm out in Pittsburgh, and I don't know, I was there a while. A little less than a year I was out there, and I get a job with the Pittsburgh Pirates, and that's his favorite team in the whole world, is the Pittsburgh Pirates. And I absolutely can't stand this man, and he is my problem, and the only way I can think to get even with him is to mail him a copy of me sitting in front of the Pittsburgh Pirates billboard. And like a month later, I can't figure out how he found me. You know what I mean? I'm like, I don't know how he found me. And so he does find me, but thank God he really didn't find me physically. What happened was I usually call on Sundays because we always have that Sunday dinner at his parents' house after church and after Sunday school. You know, I call his parents' house with a calling card from a phone that can't be traced. And my son gets on the phone, and I heard my son say something. He said to me, Mom, are you in Pittston? And I said, no, buddy. What is, you know, he said, no, I mean Pittsburgh. And I freaked out, you know, because nobody knew where I was. I wasn't allowed to tell my mother. I wasn't allowed to tell anybody where I was at. And I said, no, buddy, where did you hear that? And he said, oh, I don't know, Mom. I just heard it. You know, I don't know where I heard it. And I knew that he really couldn't answer too many questions. So I said, buddy, just answer Mom yes or no. I said, is your dad standing next to you? And he said, no. I said, is your dad on his way here? And he said, yes. So I hung up the phone, and with the clothes on my back and the money I had in my purse, which wasn't much because I'm getting it in, you know what I mean? I really was low on funds. Got on a bus, and I moved to Wilkes-Barre. I moved back to, you know, that part of the state. And some good people in AA called them up and lied to them and told them I'm still sober and I need some help and I need a place to hide. And what do good standing members of Alcoholics Anonymous do? They help you, you know. And they did. They found me. They helped me find a job, and they helped me find a nice little place to live. And it was an under-the-table job where, like, nobody could trace my Social Security number. And I'm in this apartment building, and, like, within 3 months, there's this guy who lives next to me who I noticed some people coming up and down the steps. And I'm like, I wonder what he's doing, you know. And we get to talking, and then we get to dating. And, pretty sick. And because that's what I do, you know what I mean? I'm still in the hole. I have no idea that I suffer from a spiritual malady and there's a hole in my soul. I have no idea. I just know that this last guy I was with was a jerk. And this guy looked me in the eye and said, I can't believe he did that to you. I'll never do that to you. That's awful, you know? I mean, he's a drunk like me. What else is he going to say, you know? But I don't see that because my vision includes the man, the car, the job, the house. You know, and I'm lonely, and I'm filled with fear. So anyway, I start dating this guy, and 5 years into that relationship, almost 5 years into that relationship, I come out of 11-day coma. The left side of my head is crushed in. My shoulder's broken in like a million places, and I'm on a morphine drip for a little over 2 months. Not a victim, guys. Shut up for all that. Let me tell you, I can give as good as I get. He upset me one day so bad that I actually bought him a bottle of Jim Beam. And I waited for him to drink the whole bottle, and when he passed out, I was duct taping him to the bed. And I got all three limbs down, and the other one was free, and he opened his eyes. And I ran, because that's what I do. But, you know, like, I'm not a victim. You know what I mean? I was willing to show for all those things. All those things absolutely included me getting another drink. I was willing to be there for it all, you know. Because I planned a lot of events in my life, but I've never planned the results, you know. And like I said, when that guy said to me, I'll never lay my hands on you, I can't believe that he did that to you, I wanted to believe what he said to me. I absolutely wanted to believe that. That's what I wanted, you know. I never stopped for a moment to think that that was absolutely possible, that that could happen to me again. I just knew that he did what I did, you know what I mean? And this was a match made in heaven, you know. Like, because he worked, and I liked to work, you know what I mean? When I could show up, you know. So anyway, he ended up getting sentenced 5 to 10 years. For that, for attempted homicide, and he ended up doing 2.5, which is not important because he's one of us, you know, and I got to make amends for that man. But anyway, I come out of that hospital with another habit, and this is absolutely Alcoholics Anonymous. I need to tell you that I start my day every day with a fifth of vodka, and I end it with a fifth of vodka. I absolutely get my alcohol in me every single day. I can't get out of bed without it. So, I have another habit, and I'm in love. This stuff allows me to do exactly what I've always wanted to do. My house is spotless, you know, I'm awake, and I'm now an illegal pharmacist, you know what I mean? God, I went from being a lawyer to an illegal pharmacist, you know? So anyway, you know, I was there maybe about 3 months, living like that, and I was about 72 pounds. And there was nothing left to drink at. The husband's gone, the boyfriend's gone, the kids are gone, the job's gone. I'm not capable of being employed anywhere because I can't even get out of bed in the morning to show up for anything. And I decided at this point that, like, I was pretty much done being here on this earth. Wasn't really anything left for me, you know, and I'm still getting it in me, you know. And what I do is the guy next to me who illegally purchases stuff off of me has a gun, and I know he has a gun, so I go next door to his house. And I sneak it out of his nightstand. I go back to my apartment, and I have it all ready. And I look up in the air, and I said to what I believe now is a prayer. I looked up and I said, "Look, if this is not what you want from me, you better let me know because I'm willing to do this. I'm done, you know." And within 3 seconds, I swear to God, within 3 seconds, my door is always locked. I am paranoid schizophrenic at this point in my life. My door is locked at all times. My door just opened up. And a girl whose name is also Lori, who I'd worked with before in a past job, who tried to keep in touch with me every now and then, walked in my door. And she looked at me, and I'm in this little tank top and a pair of shorts, and, you know, I'm like 72 pounds because I haven't eaten in months. And she looked at me, and she said, "You're coming with me." And I was like, "Okay." You know what I mean? What do you say to that? How do you say no, I'm not, and fight that? You know what I mean? So I did, and within 3 hours I was in a treatment facility, and that was April 16th of 2005. And, you know, I was in that treatment facility, and 19 days I spent in detox. I had the DT so bad that I shook for 19, well, I shook a lot longer than that, but 19 days without being able to put, like, a glass of juice to my mouth. I was actually in a cafeteria once, and, like, and every time I went to grab this juice, I swear everybody was staring at me. They had to be. It was like a big, like, circus. I mean, by the time I got the juice to my mouth, it was everywhere but in my mouth. It was everywhere, you know. And this girl sat next to me this one day, and she just stuck a straw in it. You know what I mean? I was like, I'm like, that's fabulous. You know, I finally got that juice in me, and I was like, oh, my God, it's just a straw, you know. And so while I was in there, you know, people come in like they do, you know, and good standing members of Alcoholics Anonymous come in, they carry a message, and you know, if you're in things like Halfway House, Sober House, Recovery House. And I know those things were being mentioned in the past. I was in 6 treatment facilities, you know. And I've heard them, but, like, I don't think they were ever mentioned to me. I've heard them being mentioned to other people, you know. And so I had this, like, all of a sudden it just struck me. And I ran to my counselor, and I'm like, look, I need to check out one of those houses, you know. And she's like, well, what are you talking about? And I said, well, I remember somewhere along the way that there was, like, a Halfway House or a Sober House. And I think that's where I need to go, because I know when I leave here, I'm only going to do exactly what I know how to do. I don't know how to do anything else, you know, and I've never realized that until that very moment, you know, and I absolutely became powerless, you know, and I knew what it meant to be powerless for the first time in my life. And she said, okay. So she did. She set me up for the place, and I ended up going to that place. I stayed 90 days, and while I was in there, there was these women that would come in and carry a message, and this one woman in particular, her name was Brenda, and she ended up to be my first sponsor. And she came in and she carried a message, and she absolutely lived the way I lived and ended up to be an Alcoholics Anonymous, and she was happy, joyous, and free. And I heard her say some words like, you know, those are not the things, you know, those are things that I did, that's not who I am. And for the first time in my life, I heard, you know, that I'm not a piece of shit, I'm one of God's kids, you know, that I deserve the very best. And it really hit me, and I heard that for the first time in my life, you know. I heard the word God, you know, and like my eyes just opened up, and I ran up to her and I asked her to be my sponsor. And she was my sponsor. She was my first sponsor, and she showed up, and this woman said, be ready at 4:30, better be ready at 4, because she was there like a half hour, hour early every time. And she took me everywhere. We went on trips everywhere. Her car was always filled with women. You know, she brought me through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I did my first, fourth, and fifth step with her. You know, she absolutely showed me a different way than the way I was living, and I'll be forever grateful to her. I had about 9 months sober, and I was absolutely sober. You know, I was definitely living different, and I was thinking different, and things were getting better. But I had this friend who got sober out here in New York, Pennsylvania, and she started bringing me to meetings out there. And I was like, what, are you kidding me? We're going to drive 3 hours to go to a meeting? There's like a meeting 10 minutes away from here, you know what I mean? Like, my first sponsor drove me to a lot of meetings, but they were pretty much local. You know what I mean? Like, that's what they did back there. And I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm not absolutely saying it's wrong. It absolutely worked for her. She's 19 years sober, you know? But what I heard out in New York, Pennsylvania, was this thing they were talking about. It was called the hole in the soul. And I heard this woman, her name is Patty, and a lot of you know her here tonight, and she became my sponsor. She was up on stage, and she was sharing this message. Like, there was no holding back with this woman. She wasn't ashamed of anything she was sharing at that podium. And that's what I wanted. I wanted to never be ashamed of who I was ever again. And I started to feel like that I could do, you know, if I followed this woman, something different in me would change. And so I did. I ran up to her and asked her to be my sponsor. Now, I live 200 miles from this woman, you know, like almost 200 miles. I don't know what it really is. Who knows? I'm alcoholic. It's probably 100 miles. But but anyway, she said, absolutely. She said, I'll definitely be your sponsor. So, like, she would drive there, and I'd drive there, and she'd call me on the phone, and we'd do step work over the phone, and, you know, she asked me, you know, do I believe I'm alcoholic? And I said, I do believe I'm alcoholic. She said, do you know what that actually means? And I'm like, I think I do. She said, well, I want you to be certain that you know what that is, because a lot of people come in these rooms, and they say they're alcoholic, and they have no idea what it really is, you know what I mean? And they absolutely believe in their hearts that that's who they are. But there's some people in here that are not who we are. You know, they didn't drink the way I drank. You know, they don't make the decisions that I make. You know, they don't act the way I act. I'm not saying those 12 steps can't help everyone. They absolutely do. But the hopeless variety alcoholic of me, I need to practice those principles in all my affairs. I need to take action. I need to live in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, just not know what it's about. You know, so I have no idea what time it is, guys. Okay. So anyway, she said to me, you know, when you put alcohol in you, do you know when you're going to stop? And when you stop, do you know when you're going to start again? I said, absolutely not. And she said, and I know that every time I've ever put in anything in me, it was always for the effect, because I never liked who I was, where I was, ever, ever. I've always had a decision immediately, from the moment I started drinking, to black out. I never had any other goal. Anytime I drank, I didn't want to drink to get giddy to meet the guy across the bar. I could care less about him. That's how self-centered I am. I just wanted to black out everywhere I was, because I thought way too much during the day on how my life was going to be. You know, and I thought I deserved that drink at night to just slow down my brain. And that's what it did for a really long time. It absolutely was my solution, you know. But it stopped working, obviously, or I wouldn't be here. So anyway, she asked me after that if I believed in God. And I said, yeah, I believe in God. And she said, then you need a bigger God. And I knew exactly what she was talking about, you know, because the God of my understanding back then, I always knew that God was the answer, guys. Like, I was raised Catholic, and I married a Methodist, and I'll never forget when I went to my parents to tell them that I was getting married in a Methodist church, and I was converting to that. My mother was furious. She was livid. You know, she's like, I'm not coming to your wedding. That's, like, blasphemy. You know, my father's in a hospital bed, and I'll never forget his words. He said to my, he looked up at my mother, he said, what are you crying about? He said, she was never a good Catholic. Maybe she'll be a good Methodist. You know what I mean? Like, that's how my father was all the time, you know? And so anyway, like, I need to tell you, throughout my marriage, like, I was studying with Jehovah's Witnesses. Like, I always knew that the answer was God. But I'll tell you, when I became Method, I started going to Bible study, you know, because I'm trying to be the perfect wife and the perfect, and I wanted to know about God, you know what I mean? So I wanted to pass that on to my kids, you know? And I remember reading this. This is what I remember reading. Better to have known me in sin. No, better to have not known me in sin than to have known me in sin. Well, that was it. Once I picked up again, I knew I was doomed. I thought God was the only thing to do with me. You know, and I had that sunk in my brain for a really long time. But what I didn't realize was that, like, I was seeking religion. I wasn't seeking God. You know what I mean? I was trying to find out what kept everybody else perfect. You know what I mean? And so anyway, I proceeded to go through the rest of the steps with this woman. And she asked me, you know, we went through the third step prayer together. And she asked me if I, you know, was I willing to turn my will and my life over to the care of God? And I said, I am willing to do anything. I was willing to do anything when I was out there, you know what I mean? I didn't see it then, but I absolutely see it now. And she asked me if I understood what that meant. And I said, you know what? I never did. I always looked at that step every time I come into AA, and I thought, I can't do that. I knew that I couldn't do that. You know what I mean? I absolutely, there was no way I was turning my will over to anything. I had too many things left to manage in my life. So that step was, well, the rest of them were out of the question too, okay? So step three, just like, that was it. And, yeah, so I was absolutely willing to turn my life, my will and my life over to the care of God. You know, my whole life I tried to run things the way I want them to, and, like, people never acted the way I wanted to, and I never acted the way people wanted me to either. I know that, like, I would try, you know, like if somebody, I'd be telling somebody to do something, they didn't do it, you know, they didn't do it the way I wanted to. Like, I'd think, well, let me just raise my voice, you know, let me just raise my voice a little. And I'll raise my voice, and, like, that doesn't work. So I'm like, well, let me just put my hand on them and yell a little louder, you know, maybe they'll do what I want then, you know. I'm like, that's my story, that's my life. I just need to get my point across to you so you'd leave me alone, you know. And like, that just doesn't work, you know, I'm off the hook. People are never going to act the way I want them to. So that third step, you know, definitely willing to stop running my life because I ran it into the ground. My ideas were absolutely smashed at that point. Fourth and fifth step, not a problem. Wasn't afraid of that. For the first time in my life, I was willing to do that step. You know, I was thorough and honest. I wanted to get rid of that crap. At first, I was excited because I thought that I got to bitch that people, you know, that first. She's like, write this column, just write down the names. I'm like, yes. You know, I get to write down the names. I get to tell her about all the things that people did to me, you know. And that's not what they're about, you know. Of course, this stuff is not about that. But, you know, if that's what gets you to write it, then so be it, because that's what got me to start writing it. And anyway, I went through that with her. And like I said, the seventh step, guys, favorite step in the whole world, because I finally, after doing that fifth step, got to see who I really was. And then all my life, you know, I'm directing and retaliating and stepping on people's toes and, you know, like chasing money, men, you know, like whatever would fill that hole, you know. And like, I remember, you know, as a small child, not wanting to be that person, wanting to be a giver, not a taker. Ended up to be a taker, and it was shown to me on paper in black and white. Those things I wrote on that paper. My foster didn't write them down. I wrote those things down. You know, what she pointed out to me was a different perception. You know, her perception of what I did to get to where I was. You know, and I could not ignore that. I could not ignore that. And then she told me, you know, like all I had to do from this point on was to like go make some amends, continue on with prayer and meditation. God bless you. And with the rest of the steps, and I did. I'm not going to run through the steps with you. I'm sure, you know what I mean? Like, people do that at the podium. I sometimes do, too. But I can tell you that 10, 11, and 12 were really important for me. And they still are to this day. The problem is that I started at a little over 2 years sober. I was in college. I went back to college, guys. I went back to school. I'm a criminal justice major. My kids are back in my life. That mother who I was very, very nasty to, like, made those amends, you know, she loved me, she absolutely loved me. I don't know, if I had 8 kids in 6 years, I probably would have slept till noon, too, you know what I mean? Like, I have no idea, you know, but, like, my perception of what people should do and what people shouldn't do, you know, I'm so arrogant, you know, and I had no idea that that's who I was. But anyway, so I got to make a lot of amends, financial amends. One of my favorites was I ended up to work for this place, and they didn't have cameras, you know. And I continued daily to take a little bit here and a little bit there, and it became a lot more than a little bit. And they never fired me for that. They actually never fired me. I quit. I got into an argument with the owner and quit. And I left there, and they never knew that I had taken a thing from them. But I knew when I got sober that I had taken that. And I knew the only way to be free, you know, happy, joyous, and free, was to write them on that list and be willing to make the amends. And I need to tell you, for a whole year, I lived in fear. I really didn't. I didn't have the courage to go to them. I didn't. But what I did do for a year, because I knew I was wrong and I knew I had to make that amends, was I mailed them anonymous money orders for $20 a week. Until I got the courage. I prayed every day for the willingness, and I finally did. And I called them and I asked them if they had a moment of their time for me. And at first they denied me that. They're like, no, we do not want to see you. We're not impressed with the way you left us. And I'm like, okay. No, you have no idea I took anything. They just think that I left. You know what I mean? And so I continued on with some other amends, financial, family. I kept showing up, you know what I mean, living amends for my family. And it was eating away at me, you know what I mean? I knew that these people had no idea what I did to them, and I was wrong. And so I called them up again about 8 months later, and I said, look, you know, if you ever find it in your heart to meet with me, this is my number. Could you please call me? And she called me a week later, and she said, you know, we're willing to sit down with you. And I showed up, with a big chunk of money. And And I said, look, this is who I am. You know, I can't tell you I'm sorry, because if I was sorry, I wouldn't have done it. What I can tell you, I was wrong, and I'm absolutely responsible, and I want to make it right. And they were like blown away. They had no idea I stole a dime from them. You know what I mean? They just thought I was like just somebody who left because I was angry that day. You know? And so anyway, I set up payment arrangements with them, and I did. I was making those arrangements. And one day I went to show up at another payment. Didn't feel I was done, and I showed up, and I went to hand them money, and they pushed my hand back and said, no, we think you're done. And I said, okay, you know. And I was driving down the hill to get gas in my car that same day, and I'm like, yes, I can go buy a new outfit, you know what I mean? I can finally go shopping. And that wasn't what happened. What happened was God had a different plan for me. I pulled into the gas station, and this gentleman was walking out that was not on my list. Completely forgot about this guy. Just walked out, and I had exactly in my pocket what I owed that man. And I saw him, and he saw me, and I looked up at him, and I said, you know, you may not remember me, but I owe you some money. And I said, and when I did that night, I need to tell you that I lied to you. My electric wasn't being shut off, you know. And he's like, oh. He's like, okay. And I'm like, well, I'd like to pay you back, and I'm really, you know, hopefully, whatever, you know, from this moment on, I won't ever be that person again, and he's like, no, I don't want the money. I'm like, no, take the money, please take the money, you know, because I know what I'm going to do with that money. I'm going to go get myself a new pair of shoes. And so anyway, he took the money, and like, I believe that was absolutely God. There was no way that was anything but God, you know what I mean, because I was going by myself. I'm self-centered, you know what I mean, I was justified. Oh, I'm good, I'm done, I'm paying those men. See how good I am, you know what I mean? And my first thought was of myself. You know, I'm alcoholic. I'm always going to be alcoholic. So I'm going to college. I only have 5 minutes left. I'm trying to make this fast. I'm in college. I'm like almost two and a half years into college. And last Thanksgiving, actually God placed another a guy. I don't know if God did it. I say it was God. Because if God is everything, I believe it was God. God placed a gentleman in my life, and so I swore off men. Believe me, guys. The last thing I was looking for when I got here was you, because you were the root of all my problems. And when I got sober, I left that women's halfway house, and I signed myself into a three-quarter house, and I don't have any charges, no arrest, no nothing. Well, I have one disorderly conduct, but that was because I don't know when to shut up, you know what I mean? After I get let go from a DUI, I don't know when to shut up, so they cuffed me because I called the cop a liar, you know? But so anyway, I, you know, this guy's in my life, and I'm going to college, and now I'm working 70 hours a week. Okay, I'm working 70 hours a week. I am going to school 3 nights a week, and I'm doing AA once a week. And what proceeds to happen is I'm answering the phone for my girls every once in a while. Well, when they call, you know what I mean? Because I stopped taking girls to sponsor because I'm really busy. You know what I mean? Like, I'm really busy. And this is the attitude I get back, the arrogance that starts to come back. And what happens is a year ago Thanksgiving, I was diagnosed with cancer. And I got a big resentment towards God, you know. I got a real big resentment towards God. How can you do this to me? I can't believe, like, I just went through all this, you know. I'm back in college, you know, my kids are back in my life, I'm going to school, you know, I've paid all these amends, how could you do this to me, you know, and I'm so, like, arrogant, you know. And so I go through the chemo. I have 2 weeks left of chemo, and my boyfriend just died, you know. It was in February of this year. He died. He passed away. It was a freak thing. He wasn't supposed to die. He died sober. At this point, I'm done with God. I'm done with AA. I don't want anything to do with you people. I don't want anything you have. I've tried it your way, and this is what I get, you know, filled with arrogance. Again, right back from the moment I entered AA. And I forget that, like, every one of those things were a gift, and I don't believe at that point that God gave me something to experience. I'm not asking him for the opportunity to grow. I didn't thank him for that opportunity to grow. What I did was I thought of myself again, and on April 14th of this year, I drank for 13 hours. The first 2 hours, I got it in, and it wasn't working, and I thought it just might start working. So I continued to drink the rest of the day, and what happened was I came out of a blackout. And I realized at that point, that's not who I wanted to be again. I remembered that that's not what I wanted to do. And I knew that if I continued on from that day, within a week, I'd probably be dead. And I thought about calling my sponsor, and I knew she was in bed. So what I did was I called her boyfriend, who was a great member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he was on a plane. And I said, look, you need to come get me now. I'm going to kill myself. And he said, listen, he said, I'll have somebody there as soon as possible, just stay by the phone. And I said, okay, and I passed out again. And when I came to, I was over my friend's shoulder being carried down some steps. And then I came to again, and I was in his attic on a couch, locked in. And then I came to again, and my clothes were being packed up. And what happened was they packed up my car, members of Alcoholics Anonymous who loved me, and they packed up my car, and they called my sponsor out in York, and she knew I was coming, and they sent me on my merry way. And what happened was when I got here to York, Pennsylvania, members of Alcoholics Anonymous were unpacking my car, and members of Alcoholics Anonymous were packing up my house back in Wilkes-Barre. And I'm forever grateful for that. I have not had a drink since. I would love to sit here and tell you that my sober date was April 16th of 2005, but it's not. It's actually April 16th of 2008, and I don't regret any of that. I absolutely don't regret any of it. I know now that, like, it's real easy to get self-seeking again in this program. I believe in my heart of hearts that all that experience was useful, you know, and I get to share it with all my girls today. I hope I'm carrying a message of hope here today. I absolutely love showing up. When Jack asked me that day, I wasn't sure if he knew how much time I had, and you know what I thought about I'm always worried about my image. What do I care how much time I have, you know? My sponsor told me that lack of steps was not my problem, it was lack of trust in God, you know? And that was absolutely the truth. Lack of trust in God, me thinking that I had to be in there managing everything again, and I got carried away, you know, and I justified all of it by, and I got to pay all these amends off, I'm never gonna get ahead, and I'm working 70 hours a week, and I'm going to school, and all those things came back, guys, real easy, you know, and I was so distracted, and I know it's 9 o'clock, I just want to share with you another thing. I've since gotten sober in York, Pennsylvania, and I absolutely believe that that's where I belong. and that's where I've been the most effective in my life. My mother, I need to tell you that 3-4 months sober, my mother was diagnosed again with lung cancer, and my brother called me and he said, look, she's not going to make it through the night, and I said, okay, I got in my car. No, actually, my car was about to blow up, okay. And friends in New York and members of Alcoholics Anonymous drove me to Scranton, Dunmore, which is where my mom was from. And when I got there, she was already, like, unconscious. They had her on a morphine drip just to, like, spare her the pain. And we knew it was going to be a matter of minutes. So my sisters and my family left, and they let me be alone with her. And my mother, growing up, had fake eyebrows. I don't know if any of you guys remember, but, like, you know that brown-orange eyebrow pencil? You know? Well, she would shave her eyes, and she told us that she was born without eyebrows, you know what I mean? And we believed her. We had no idea. So when I walked in the room and I laid on the bed next to her and I looked down and I saw that her eyebrows were missing, I went in and I got to put them on her, you know what I mean? I got to pencil those on her head. And then I looked closer and I see a couple of hairs coming through, and I'm like, she lied. She lied all them years. You know? And but anyway, the point is I got to make the best amends I ever could to my mother, you know what I mean? Because I would have never done that. I never probably would have showed up. I probably would have been sloshed somewhere, you know, sat there at the bar telling everybody how, you know, what a victim I am. My mother is gone, you know, because when my father died, he died 11 years sober and I was drunk, you know, and my mom passed away, I got to show up sober, you know, the daughter that I always wanted to be. And for that, I'm ever grateful, and that's AA, and I'm grateful to all you guys, and thanks for having me. That's all I have.